Several years ago, I was at a family dinner talking to my Uncle Richard. He's a neurologist, and I was still in training. Deeply aware of my own inadequacies, we were discussing what role, if any, shame plays in helping us learn from our mistakes. Richard recalled how on his own neurology rotation in medical school, each student was assigned to examine a patient and then describe the findings to the attending and the rest of the team. When Richard finished his first presentation, the attending looked at him and said, "There are two possibilities. Either you're demented, or the patient is demented." As my uncle recalled, he'd given a very disjointed history because the patient had been digressive, and my uncle wasn't experienced enough yet to interpret the cause of the patient's confusion. But as Richard reminded me, in those days, insulting a student was considered a way to motivate them. And it worked for him. Soon he learned to take more detailed and clearer histories, and the interaction stands out as a pivotal moment for his learning and growth to this day. Now, of course, the attending's comments would be considered totally inappropriate, and I think that's a welcome change. We have much less tolerance for harassment and humiliation, and we're far more attuned to student and trainee well-being. But my uncle's story also reminded me that for some people, it can be constructive to be so blatantly criticized. So as we pay more attention to our students' well-being, being careful not to offend, have we become too afraid to give honest feedback? How do we know that we're still fostering excellence? And how do we separate the moments of shame or anxiety that shape us into better doctors from those that can paralyze us and prevent us from learning at all? I'm Lisa Rosenbaum, and this is Not Otherwise Specified from the New England Journal of Medicine. To get various takes on these questions, we'll have three guests today. Our first is Dr. Karen Hauer, Vice Dean of Education at University of California, San Francisco, where I also went to medical school. She'll be talking about the role of well-being and some of the curricular changes that UCSF has made. She got her PhD in education, and her work is focused on a host of factors that impact student well-being, including educational assessment, competency-based learning, remediation, and equity. Karen and I talked a bit about changes that have been made nationwide out of concern for student well-being. These include new norms for the kinds of comments that are and aren't acceptable for attendings to make to students, and avenues for recourse if inappropriate behavior occurs. And then I asked her about UCSF's decision to stop giving students letter grades on their clinical rotations. What had motivated the decision, and how common is pass-fail grading among medical schools?
Grading is particularly challenging when you're grading clinical performance as opposed to grading performance in a classroom-based setting. There are many different ways that schools approach the task of assigning clerkship grades. There was a study by Eric Alexander and colleagues looking at the different grading schemes used in medical schools, and there were many, many different grading schemes and many different percentages of students receiving the highest grades. So if someone like a residency program selection committee is trying to interpret what those grades mean, it's very difficult to compare a top grade from one school to a top grade at another school. So that is one challenge with clerkship grading. There are many more. For years, students have told us that they don't feel like clerkship grades are fair, that they don't know how they're going to be evaluated by individual supervisors. They feel that exam scores disproportionately contribute to the grade that is assigned, and that the whole process is not predictable or objective. And it's not really possible to make all evaluators behave the same in the way that they interact with students. The additional factor that is problematic with clerkship grading that tipped our institution to make a change to our approach to clerkship assessment and grading were the problems that we found with equity in assignment of clerkship grades. Our students had been telling us for years about the problems with fairness and the influences on their learning and wellness. We then had students come forward and say that it appeared to them that the students selected for the AOA Medical Honor Society at our school were more white and less diverse than the student body as a whole. We undertook an analysis of our clerkship data, looking back over multiple years of data, and found that the scores assigned to students who were from backgrounds underrepresented in medicine were very slightly less on average in all eight of our core clerkships than for students from backgrounds not underrepresented in medicine. That very small tenth of a point difference in assessed performance on our rating scale led the students who were underrepresented in medicine to be about half as likely to earn clerkship honors and about a third as likely to be selected for the AOA Medical Honor Society. As we looked at those findings, on top of the other concerns about clerkship grading that we had tried for years to address without really allaying students' concerns about the negative impacts of clerkship grading, we decided it was time to make a bigger change. So at our institution, we redesigned our clerkship assessment system to eliminate the use of tiered grades. We switched to pass-fail grades, and we emphasized assessment for learning, which is the feedback, the formative type of assessment that gives students information about how they're learning and where they need to go next, and de-emphasize the summative assessment, the high-stakes assessment, while at the same time still committing to making sure that all students met our clerkship expectations and were prepared to move on to the next phase of their training.
So I think at some point after you implemented this change, you did a qualitative study at UCSF. In that study, faculty talked about what they perceived to be the benefits, but they also expressed some concerns. And one concern was that it would decrease people's motivation.
We hear that question a lot about, are people motivated if they don't have the opportunity to earn grades? When we made our change, we committed to studying the effects of our change using quantitative and qualitative measures and getting the perspectives of students and faculty. The students that we interviewed gave us their take on the question of motivation under a pass-fail grading situation, and they strongly said, we are motivated to be doctors. This is why we came to medical school. If we only came to medical school to get a top grade, then that wouldn't really be a reason to do all of this. We are internally motivated to serve our patients. So that brings up the important distinction between internal and external motivators. External motivators are not the only or the best motivators. And if you think about needing that external motivation to be a good physician, then we would really have a problem thinking about how our residents and how our fellows and practicing physicians motivated. They don't get grades.
I asked Karen whether after the switch to pass-fail, students' well-being improved.
Our students said that their wellness improved in several ways. One is that their overall stress level during the core clerkships decreased so that they were able to focus more on their learning. Secondly, they reported feeling more human on their teams, more being seen as a whole person, not just the student trying to impress the resident or the faculty. We heard from students, residents, and faculty that some things went away that really should go away, like the whole song and dance about the student trying to be able to go home by telling people they're willing to stay late and trying to impress everyone instead of just deciding when it's time to go home. Students also felt more agency around how to use their time well. For instance, deciding when is it a good time for me to be with the patient or to be with my intern or to study for my exam, to make those decisions as an autonomous, self-determined learner rather than as someone trying to impress the team.
I also asked her whether there were any unintended consequences. I've heard, for instance, that students now feel even more pressure to distinguish themselves, say with research output or other extracurriculars, if residency programs can't rely on grades to differentiate among applicants.
We get asked a lot about deferral of stress or shifting of stress. Around the time that we made our grading change in 2019, the discussions were happening around changing step one to pass-fail, which did end up happening in 2022. So people asked the question, well, have you shifted all the stress to the fourth year? And I would say, yes, students are stressed about applying in the residency match, but we don't have any information to suggest that's more stressful than it was before. It's a shorter period of time in that early part of the fourth year. But that is something that we do get asked about. Another thing that people bring up is how students navigate their participation in extracurriculars, and are they spending more time on research or volunteerism or other activities during clerkships than they might have if they were trying for honors. I don't know. We did hear students, even when we had grades, say, well, in certain clerkships, I'm just not going to try for honors, and that will let me have more time for other things. But I think that question about if they're pursuing non-clerkship-related activities during clerkships really puts the onus on the clerkship educators and the school to make sure that the standards are high and are upheld for what constitutes sufficient performance to pass the rotation and to meet the expectations of that clerkship.
It's too soon to know how moving away from these objective scores will affect both well-being and competence, but it's also possible we'll never really know. Studying these types of curricular changes is extremely difficult. Well-being and competency are dynamic and difficult to measure, and also learning and motivation, as my uncle pointed out, are so intensely personal. What works for some people just doesn't work for others. One thing that's clear, though, is that the more we move away from objective measures, the more we'll depend upon feedback to help students and trainees learn. But feedback can be equally fraught. In my reporting, I heard from a lot of faculty, and also from a bunch of senior trainees, that they've become hesitant to give candid feedback, especially in the written record, because they fear being accused of mistreatment. At the same time, feedback is critical to the development of excellence. So we're going to spend the next few minutes talking to Dr. Alyssa Zeglin, a primary care physician at Froedtert and the Medical College of Wisconsin. Alyssa completed her med-peds residency at Case Western Reserve University in 2022 and then did a chief year from 2022 to 2023. Due to some of these tensions around feedback, she's been involved in a focus group study trying to understand the challenges from the perspectives of both trainees and faculty.
Faculty was kind of noticing, especially after COVID and the pandemic, this kind of disconnect between trainees and educators. And they heard this term, retaliatory teaching, which to them seemed like an oxymoron, right? So like teaching is always about building people up. How could it be retaliatory? But that was a lot of how some of the learners felt, and trying to really investigate what has changed, what can we do better, and where is the disconnect? Because if we don't address it, it's just going to get worse.
And what does retaliatory teaching mean?
Yeah, so it really means just trying to shame in an effort to teach. So trying to make people feel less than or retaliate towards them for something that the faculty member maybe didn't like about them or something like that. Bias and using this as a way to shame them in front of others or family members or colleagues, things like that.
So what did you find in the focus groups?
Yeah, so, you know, I'll start with the resident focus groups. And my favorite thing out of all of them was this resident talked about the difference between being shamed and feeling shame. And I thought that was so poignant because shame in and of itself is not always bad. And that's what the resident described. So they described a time when they were triaging a patient and they didn't realize that the patient was as sick as the patient was. And the attending told them and they felt shame because they made a mistake and they wanted to do what was best for the patient and they missed something. And that shame was a motivator, but the attending never made them feel shamed because you didn't shame them in front of the family or in front of their colleagues, and gave them that space to learn and grow. And then that resident practiced on all their other rotations, asked for feedback, then came back to the same rotation, and the attending commented on how much they had progressed and how they had really gained that skill. So I thought that was something that we don't hear a lot about. You know, it's when you call out the behavior and not the person.
So these focus groups, did they consist of faculty and trainees together, or were the interviews done separately?
They were totally separate, so as not to kind of bias the different groups and to allow for that space to really reflect in an anonymous setting. And so I can tell you a little bit about the faculty, too.
Yeah, I'd love to hear.
So the faculty had a lot of different things to say. I think a big thing was, you know, we talk about the divide between power from a trainee perspective to a faculty, but faculty are also worried about what the ramifications are going to be from their reviews or their evaluations. And a lot of the faculty had an experience with maybe one resident that went really poorly, and then that kind of colored how they went about things, and the sense of fear that I'm going to say something and then it's going to come back on me, even though I'm just trying to teach them. And so then they, you know, there's this feeling of maybe I should not say anything, or, you know, now I have to really get all my ducks in a row and make sure that I have everything documented. And now it's 3 months later before I can actually give feedback.
So in your community, within the medical school and the program, did having these focus groups lead to meaningful change? Were you able to communicate the results to people?
Yeah, so I think it's hard for me to say across the institution, right? Because my experience is very specific to certain subspecialties, but we really focused on feedback and teaching people how to give feedback. No one ever teaches you how to do that. And I, you know, did my grand rounds on like growth mindset and feedback. And then as the chief, I led feedback sessions for all the interns. And we really tried to cultivate that both within the attendings and the fellows and the residents and the students, and making sure that we're all on the same page and that we're all explicit in the expectation that we will be giving feedback, and here are the ways that we can do it in a kind and clear way.
And so what are some big tips on giving feedback? I would like to know.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the biggest tip that we heard from residents especially is setting an expectation up front. And then when you give that, you set the expectation at the start of the rotation, you're going to give feedback. Then when you say, okay, it's time for feedback, the resident or student is not like, oh my God, something awful is happening, they're giving me feedback because I must be doing something wrong. It's, no, we're all going to do this. Even more so if you're doing family-centered rounds and you want to correct real time, which is a really valuable source of feedback, and setting that expectation for the families so that everyone is clear that this is a learning environment. No one is trying to shame people. And if you see this intern get a question wrong, it doesn't mean that they are any less capable in caring for you or your child or your loved one. So expectations. And then the other things that are really important is clear is kind, right? I think Brene Brown says that, and plenty of other people, right? Clear is kind. So don't dance around the truth. And then number two is be timely. Like the residents gave an example of receiving feedback a couple of months later, just in written form. And it was not good feedback. It was very bad. And this resident had very different understanding of what went on. They had no idea that the attending felt this way. Now they're wondering, okay, well, am I an imposter? Does everyone think this about me and they're just not willing to say this? Does, you know, what happened. I can't even remember what happened 3 months ago. You know, that was a whole different lifetime. So being timely makes a really big difference, and giving that respect to have a conversation face to face.
I found Alyssa's insights very helpful. I'm so bad about doing evaluations until I've received 100 emails telling me I'm delinquent. So it's good to be reminded why that's really not helpful to trainees, nor does it help them learn. But when we think about the relationship between education and well-being, it's one thing to address these tangible aspects of training, like grading or feedback. It's much harder, though, to address problems baked into our culture. So for the rest of this episode, we're going to be talking to Chelsea Harris, a surgeon who's completing her plastic surgery fellowship at Johns Hopkins. Chelsea spent a lot of time thinking about well-being in the context of her own training. During residency, Chelsea became attuned to the various forms of trainee mistreatment, like racism, misogyny, and other forms of bias. This prompted her to create, alongside some of her colleagues, something called the Cultural Complications Curriculum. The curriculum encompasses 12 core DEI-related themes. Each case highlights a cultural breakdown meant to be explored in a morbidity and mortality type setting and discussed as we would discuss a patient complication. We'll link to the curriculum in our show notes. I started by asking Chelsea what prompted her to create the curriculum.
One of the things I talk about all the time in the early days of the curriculum is I never felt like a female college student. I never felt like a female medical student. And then I got into residency, and all of a sudden, my gender felt like it was at the forefront of my identity all the time, beyond ways that I really wanted it to be or expected it to be. Like, I just wanted to be the surgery resident. I didn't really want to be the female surgery resident. But I felt like myself and all of my colleagues were having to negotiate for authority that was automatically given to the men around us. And I think that, you know, it would be something as simple as, say, a patient was on a heparin drip and needed a PTT drawn. And, you know, it was several hours overdue. And as the female surgery resident, you would have to go into the floor and be like, "Hi, I'm Chelsea with surgery. I know that you've been like really busy and I don't want to interrupt anything that you're doing. I've collected all of the supplies. But if you please, if you just like have a moment, if you could just like the heparin drip's really important for us to titrate this." Whereas my male colleague would walk onto the floor and be like, "Hey, the heparin drip is 2 hours overdue. Can we draw it?" And they'd be like, "Oh gosh, he's so responsible and on top of it." And you're like, "Come on." So you have this false dichotomy of either being obsequious or being an ice queen. And that can be
so true.
Just it's exhausting. So true. it's exhausting. You're constantly. And one of the other things that I think I've come to recognize. So I've rotated, I think, at 17 different hospitals over the course of training. And so any of the credibility that you have built up, so that whomever you're working with knows that you're a responsible doctor and that you're respectful and you're not trying to be an ice queen, you have to start from ground zero. Over and over and over again. So you're always in the obsequious phase. And that can be just really, really exhausting. So that was kind of my entry point into starting to think about the way that identity manifests in the clinical environment. And so I kind of dove head in over heels, being like, "Oh, I just need the data to explain this to people. And then of course they will all be on my side. Like, I just need to show that this is a real thing and that there's data," and then like, boom, gender equity solved. But it turns out that just mountains of data are not really the way to convince people to change their beliefs. And we can get into all the ways that that manifests. But I think that you really have to lead with a relational approach and understand why it impacts your relations and why it impacts your connection with patients and your colleagues, and that's more effective. And the other part that I will say on this front is, I think, kind of embarrassingly, my entrance into this was all on the stuff that directly impacted me. So it was all gender specific. And I had had the kind of blinding privilege of not understanding all of the ways that identity impacts many other demographics, whether that's race, ethnicity, ability, language. There's many, many other ways that this manifests in the clinical environment. And so once I had kind of my foot in the door on the gender side of things, then I started being really deliberate about figuring out all of the other ways that identity plays a role and trying to be more deliberate in that education. And that was kind of what the cultural complications curriculum sprang from. Because I think that's a real true detriment to wellness, is that if you are having to fight to show up as your authentic self in the hospital environment all the time, that is just tremendously draining. And through the process of some of this research, I've also learned about this concept called vigilance.
Chelsea learned about this concept through the work of University of Michigan epidemiologist Margaret Hicken.
She was doing a series of studies that showed that anticipating the experience of racism, even if you never actually encounter on a daily basis racist remarks, just the fear of having to armor up to go into your environment, has concrete negative health effects, from hypertension to cardiovascular risk disease, that really does manifest in our bodies in real ways, whether or not you're actually receiving those comments on a day-to-day basis. And so I think there's some real important parts about what we expect our lives to be like and what that does for our well-being.
So the other thing to know about Chelsea, if it wasn't already totally obvious from the fact that she helped create an entire curriculum in the midst of her surgical training, is that she's extremely talented and accomplished. But despite her many successes, Chelsea also spent the majority of her training fantasizing about quitting. She gave a speech about it at one of the national surgical meetings, which was later published in the Annals of Surgery. And in the speech, in which she describes her quitting fantasy, she writes, "The question ringing through the empty corridors late at night is not whether I have enough resilience to make it in academic surgery. I know that I do. Rather, the question is, why would I stay in a place that keeps requiring so much of it?" And so I asked Chelsea why she didn't quit. Here's what she said.
That's a question I keep coming back to. Even at the times when I was kind of at the most disenchanted and exhausted and burned out in this process, that I'm too steeped in the culture of you have to show up the next day being prepared and not letting your team down or your patients down, that like, if you have 2.5 hours after you get home before you go to sleep, like I had to spend that time reviewing my case for the next day, or following up on the labs overnight, or whatever else it was, that you can't actually like conduct a job search or make a resume during that time because it's too hard to be an actual resident and look for anything else. I think a lot of us struggle with a sunk cost fallacy, this idea that I have spent $250,000 and 10 years on this training path, and I don't have a lot of other skills necessarily because I've spent so much time in this one, that like, what are the other options? And, you know, ostensibly there is a payoff at the end of this, both actually financially and in terms of being able to do the things that you want to do and help people and all of that. So whether that's the carrot that's just dangling just out of reach forever, who knows? But I think that's certainly part of the calculus that went in for me. And I think, I think a lot of people have thoughts of like, what am I doing? Or, when I ask if you could wave a magic wand and get all the time back, would you pick this path again? I get a lot of resounding no's, even from people that I wouldn't necessarily expect that from. And so I think as I've started to speak about some of the reservations that I've had on this pathway, that's opened the doors for other people to say, yeah, I share some of those. I have those concerns as well. So I think that's kind of the why I've stayed right now, the promise that it will get better. And that it will be worth it. But there are times when I look around and I worry that it won't be. I also think that there's a mentality of surgery that you don't quit. And that's conditioned into you as well. I think that's probably in other areas of medicine as well. And also there's a definite cost to those around you that, you know, the work is kind of zero sum, that anything that I'm not doing means somebody else is picking up that slack. And I have a hard time asking that of the people around, you know, the people around me are some of the most dedicated, hardworking people I've ever had the privilege to encounter. And asking them to do more seems untenable.
Was there a moment where you felt like you reached a breaking point?
Yeah, so I think this was maybe something I only came to in retrospect. But there was, last Christmas I was on call, and my family, who lives in Vermont and New York, really graciously came down to spend the time with me in Baltimore. And I had set about, you know, preparing for Christmas because I was hosting, kind of doing all of my good resident tricks leading up to it, that I had lists and I had prepped all the food that I could ahead of time, and I had this great plan about how it was all going to work. And then, as is wont to happen, once they actually arrived, you know, consults start rolling in and unanticipated things. And it, you know, turns out I had forgotten one or two things on the ingredient list. And so I sent my dad to the store to try to help patch some of the holes. And, you know, everything on the list had a question. You know, was it okay if I did? They don't have dark brown sugar, but they do have light brown sugar. They don't have this kind of juice. Is it okay if they have this kind of juice? And, you know, I'm baking at home. I'm talking to the intern on the phone as they're calling me about questions. And in my head, I'm just like, figure it out. Like, it is not that hard. It's like six less things on a list. Just get it done. And as the weekend progressed, these minor transgressions of not being self-sufficient, which also derived from my dad wanting to do a good job for me, just kept building and building. We were going to the Poconos for a couple of days once I was off call. And we had gone out for like an escape room. And afterwards, my dad's like, oh, where should we go to dinner? And I like lost my mind that he had not done any research on what might be appropriate or like what might be available in this town. It was just assuming that someone else around him would figure it out, and ended up like creating just a frankly hostile and angry environment, to the point that my parents decided to head back to Vermont a day early, kind of under the guise that my husband and I could spend time with each other, but it was like mostly an escape mission. And in the kind of days afterwards, I was sort of trying to process like why these really minor interactions had just like thrown me over the edge so much, and why I was so like, because I was truly quite angry with him. And I started realizing that it was because I was coding everything that he did as bad intern behavior, that I had given him a task and he was not able to execute it without hand holding, that he had shown up to the OR without doing reading before the case. And I just couldn't process it. And I, you know, as I had a little bit of distance from it, starting to be like, I don't think I actually want my dad to be my intern. Like that's actually not a great family dynamic. And to put everything through the lens of training, is really harmful to some of your, for lack of a better term, civilian relationships, that there's a hardening and a directness that needs to happen in training, which I think truly is a skill in some regards and is very necessary, but has barbs and can really negatively impact your view of the world and your relation to other people. And so I think that was a real, there was a sharp view of maybe what training had taken from me, mm-hmm. and what I had needed to become in order to survive.
Yeah. And were you able to talk about it with him eventually?
No, I just wrote an essay about it in Annals of Surgery and emailed and said, here's your apology.
Are you serious?
No, I mean, I did call and apologize a little bit later, but I did when the presidential address was published, I did send it to him and say, here's your formal apology. Because I do not come off as the good guy in this scenario.
No, you didn't. But I completely get it. And obviously also, I think we all take out our sharp edges on the people who can't, like, break up with us in a sense, right? Which is, like, yeah. Basically our parents. Yeah. So in your presidential address that you published, you introduce this concept of gameness, which essentially boils down to this idea that we try to select people who are willing to be brutalized, in a sense, to go all out, who are game, to go as hard as possible. And you talk about how that can be abused. So can you tell me a little bit more about how you came upon that concept and then how it left you contemplating the nature of surgical training?
Yeah, so it was actually a piece in a freshman political science class that I took that has just stuck with me since. It's a Malcolm Gladwell piece, and he writes about why we as a society found the Michael Vick dogfighting scandal so abhorrent. And he said that it's because in dogfighting, dogs are selected for a gameness, the quality that will send them back into the ring over and over again until their throats are literally ripped out. And if a dog doesn't possess gameness, it's abandoned and labeled a cur. And he writes in the essay, and this was sort of drawing parallels to the NFL and how NFL players are also selected for gameness, but that if you have a creature that is selected for gameness, you have a responsibility to protect it because it is not actually able to protect itself. And that resonated really deeply with me in terms of what I felt like my medical training had been like, that it's, you know, absorb, 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 put the smile on your face, keep going back, you know, over and over and over again, regardless of the trauma that you've seen in front of you or that you have, you know, swallow it, keep rounding, keep, you know, go on to the next surgery, whatever the next thing is. And so when I was, you know, in the piece, I was just juxtaposing kind of my reaction to my dad with gameness, that sometimes when you are, you know, bred for a fight, you start to lose the ability to distinguish between the arena and the dog park, and everything becomes a fight. And I think part of the responsibility of the organizations who select for gameness is also to protect and build barriers between the arena and the outside world, and to help people transition between the two. Because I don't think that you can sanitize or sand down all of the sharp edges of medicine. There's inherent suffering that you will encounter and that you need to be able to cope with. And I think some of that hardening and that skill set to move on to the next thing actually does need to be there. And we would be doing ourselves a disservice if you got rid of it entirely. I think the problem is when you can't disconnect from it at all. And I think that happens when you lack reserve and when you lack connection and when you lack, you know, sleep or all of the things that can humanize you again, and you just stay as the fighting dog in every single context.
When we think about well-being and its relationship to education, I think Chelsea's point is so critical, that part of well-being is about knowing when and how to turn off. But it's also about accepting that some of these discomforts are inevitable, and our education should teach us how to live with that. Here's Chelsea talking about the weight of worrying about patients postoperatively.
One of the things I often joke about is that anxiety drives flap perfusion. So for those in the audience who may not be doing a lot of free tissue transfer, the idea being you take a chunk of tissue on its blood supply and then move it to some place that you need soft tissue coverage, and then you connect the vessels underneath the microscope with suture that is thinner than a human hair. So it's a really tenuous, delicate connection, and that connection can fail in the first couple of days and the flap can go down. So you have to check it every hour, and you're really nervous, or I am really nervous in the first couple of days about how it's going to do. So I joke that the more internal turmoil I feel about how the flap is doing, the more blood flow it will get, and therefore its ultimate survival will be better.
I definitely feel Chelsea's pain. I used to get annoyed with myself for this type of pervasive anxiety about patients, the lying awake at night worrying. I thought it reflected an inability to turn off or a lack of confidence in my own judgment. But my Uncle Richard, the neurologist who I mentioned at the beginning, shifted my thinking about this. Richard has ALS, and he actually joined us in the last episode of the first season of NOS. And I'm glad we did the interview with him then, because the disease has progressed to the point that he's now unable to talk at all. But he's found a way to communicate through a Substack, typing with his few fingers that still work. And the thing to know about Richard is that he's brilliant, but he's also extremely mellow. He has an unusual equanimity. And so I never thought he'd also be so affected by these persistent worries about patients. But in one of his newsletters, he talks about having to call his own physician in the evening. And then Richard reflects about the many nights patients called him and woke him, and how he would lie awake after rethinking his advice. And when I read that, I realized, not only is this a discomfort that never goes away, but also that I wouldn't want it to. I'm Lisa Rosenbaum, and this is Not Otherwise Specified from the New England Journal of Medicine. I'd like to thank our editor, Deborah Molina, our senior producer, Mary Rose Madden, music by Blue Dot Sessions. Thanks also to Ginevra Pittman, Julie Barzilay, Sue Ellen Lee, and Abby Schubach. Next up on Not Otherwise Specified, we try to get a bit more specific about how to foster both mental health and well-being, while also recognizing that some discomfort and sacrifice is necessary in the pursuit of excellence.
The challenge is there is a direct tension between altruism, which is a tenet of medical professionalism, putting your patients in front of yourself, in front of your own needs, with the commitment to self-care and your own wellness. And so what I've seen happen is that both sides of that tension can be sort of weaponized, if you will, that, well, for my wellness, I can't do that for the patient, or you're talking about altruism because you're trying to get me to do more work. They are both noble goals. Altruism, it's really important, and wellness and self-care are really important. So how do you choose when there's a direct tension between those two concepts?
That's next time on Not Otherwise Specified from the New England Journal of Medicine. Thanks for listening. Until next week.